through them? A big yawn, and he blows out loudly.
Damn, I gotta quit staying up so late. My lungs are killing me. Got to quit smoking. Me and some of the guys in Wild Turkey hung out last night.
Another yawn.
Hold on, I'm coming too. Let me switch channels. 1 minute it's Christmas, next you're asking about Philadelphia?
That's right. The stuff you guys found in Benton's hotel room?
Yeah. Hell yeah, I went through it.
Did you take anything? Anything, for example, that might have been in his briefcase? A file, for example, that might have had letters in it?
He had a couple files in there.
Why do you want to know? I am getting excited. My synapses are firing, clearing my head, and pumping energy into my cells. Where are these files now? I ask him.
Yeah, I remember some letters. Weirdo shit that I thought I should pay some attention to. Then Lucy blew Carrie and Joyce out of the air and turned them into fish chum, and that exceptionally cleared the case, I guess you could say. Shit. I still can't believe she had a fucking AR-15 in the damn helicopter, and...
Where are the files? I ask him again, and I can't keep the urgency out of my voice. My heart is pounding. I need to see a file that had the weird letters. Benton called it his TLP file, TLP, as in The Last Precinct. Maybe where Lucy got the idea for the name.
The Last Precinct? You mean where Lucy's going to work? McGovern's place in New York? What the hell's that got to do with some file in Benton's briefcase?
Good question, I tell him.
Okay. It's somewhere. I gotta find it, and I'll be over.
Anna has gone back to her bedroom, and I occupy myself with thinking about our holiday meal as I wait for Lucy and McGovern to get here. I start pulling food out of the refrigerator as I replay what Lucy told me about McGovern's new company in New York. Lucy said the name The Last Precinct started out as a joke. Where you go when there is nowhere left. And in Anna's letter, she said Benton told her The Last Precinct is where he would end up. Cryptic. Riddles. Benton believed his future was somehow connected to what he was putting in that file. The Last Precinct was death, I then consider. Where was Benton going to end up? He was going to end up dead. Is this what he meant? Where else might he have ended up? Days ago I promised Anna I would cook Christmas dinner if she did not mind an Italian in her kitchen who does not go near a turkey or what people stuff in turkeys during the holidays. Anna has made a valiant effort at shopping. She even has cold-pressed olive oil and fresh buffalo mozzarella. I fill a large pot with water and go back to Anna's bedroom to tell her she can't go to Hilton Head or anywhere else until she has eaten a little cucina scarpetta and sampled a little wine. This is a family day, I tell her as she brushes her teeth. I don't care about special grand juries or prosecutors or anything else until after dinner. Why doesn't she make something Austrian? At this, she almost spits out toothpaste. Never, she says. If both of us were in the kitchen at the same time, we would kill each other. For a while, the mood seems to lift in Anna's house. Lucy and McGovern appear around 9, and gifts are piled under the tree. I start mixing eggs and flour and work it all together with my fingers on a wooden cutting board. When the dough is the right consistency, I wrap it in plastic and start looking for the hand-cranked pasta machine Anna claims to have somewhere as I jump from thought to thought, barely hearing what Lucy and McGovern are chatting about. It's not that I can't fly when it's not VFR conditions. Lucy is explaining something about her new helicopter, which apparently has been delivered to New York. I have my instrument rating, but I'm not interested in having an instrument-rated single-engine helicopter because with only one engine I want to see the ground at all times, so I don't want to be flying above the clouds on crappy days.
Sounds dangerous, McGovern comments.
It's not in the least. The engines never quit in these things, but it pays to always consider worst-case scenario. I begin kneading the dough. It is my favorite part of making pasta, and I always refrain from using pasta machines or food processors because the warmth of the human touch gives a texture to fresh pasta that is unlike anything agitating steel blades can effect. I get into a rhythm, pushing down, folding over, giving half turns, pressing hard with the heel of my good hand as I, too, think of worst-case scenarios. What might Benton have believed was the worst-case scenario for him? If he was thinking that his metaphorical last precinct was where he would end up, what would have been the worst-case scenario? This is when I decide he didn't mean death when he said he would end up in the last precinct. No. Benton, of all people, knew there are far worse things than death. I've given her lessons off and on. Talk about a quick study. But people who use their hands have an advantage, Lucy is saying to McGovern, talking about me. It is where I will end up. Benton's words shine in my mind. Right, because it takes coordination. Got to be able to use both hands and both feet at the same time. And unlike fixed wing, a helicopter is intrinsically unstable. That's what I'm saying. They're dangerous. It is where I'll end up, Anna. They aren't, Tian. You can lose an engine at 1,000 feet and fly it right down to the ground. The air keeps the blades turning. Ever heard of auto-rotating? You land in a parking lot or someone's yard. You can't do that with a plane. What did you mean, Benton? God damn it, what did you mean? I knead and knead, always turning the ball of dough in the same direction, clockwise, because I am leading with my right hand, avoiding my cast. Thought you said you never lose an engine. I want some eggnog. Is Marino making his famous eggnog this morning? McGovern says. That's his New Year's Eve thing. What, it's against the law on Christmas? I don't know how she does that. Stubborn, that's how. No kidding. And we're just standing here doing nothing. She won't let you help. No one touches her dough. Trust me. Aunt Kay, isn't that making your elbow hurt? My eyes focus as I look up. I am kneading with my right hand and the fingertips of my left. I glance at the clock over the sink and realize I have lost track of time and have been kneading for almost 10 minutes. God, what world were you just in? Lucy's light spirit turns to lead as she searches my face. Don't let all this eat you alive. It's going to be all right. She thinks I am worrying about the special grand jury, when ironically I am not thinking about that at all this morning. Tian and I are going to help you, are helping you. What do you think we've been doing these last few days? We've got a plan we want to talk to you about. After eggnog, McGovern says with a kind smile. Did Benton ever talk to you about the last precinct? I am out with it, almost accusing in the fierce way I look at both of them, then realizing by their confused expressions they don't know what I am alluding to at all. You mean what we're doing now? Lucy frowns. The office in New York? He couldn't have known about that unless you mentioned to him you were thinking about going into your own business. This she says to McGovern. I divide the dough into smaller parts and begin kneading again. I've always thought about going private, McGovern replies. But I never said anything about it to Benton. We were pretty consumed with the cases up there in Pennsylvania. Understatement of the century, Lucy adds blackly. Right, McGovern sighs and shakes her head. If Benton didn't have a clue about the private enterprise you planned to start, I then say, is it possible he'd heard you mention the last precinct, the concept, the thing you say you used to joke about? I'm trying to figure out why he would label a file with that name. What file? Lucy asks. Marino's bringing it over. I finish kneading one portion of dough and wrap it tightly in plastic. It was in Benton's briefcase in Philadelphia. I explain to them what Anna told me in her letter, and Lucy helps clarify at least one point. She feels certain she mentioned the philosophy of the last precinct to Benton. She seems to recall that she was in the car with him one day and was asking him about the private consulting he had begun doing in his retirement. He told her it was going all right, but it was difficult handling the logistics of running his own business, that he missed having a secretary and someone else answering the phone, that sort of thing. Lucy wistfully replied that maybe all of us ought to get together and form our own company. That was when she used the term the last precinct, sort of a league of our own, she says she told him. I spread clean, dry dish towels over the countertop. Did he have any idea you might be serious about really doing that someday? I ask.
I told him if I ever got enough money I was going to quit working for the fucking government, Lucy replies.
Well, I fit thinning rollers in the pasta machine and set them at the largest opening.
Anybody who knows you would figure it was only a matter of time before you made money doing something. Benton always said you were too much of a maverick to last in a bureaucracy forever. He wouldn't be the least bit surprised over what's happening to you now, Lucy.
In fact, it had already started happening to you from the start, McGovern points out to my niece, which is why he didn't last with the FBI.
Lucy isn't insulted. She has at least accepted that she made mistakes early on, the worst one being her affair with Carrie Grethen. She no longer blames the FBI for backing away from her until she finally quit. I flatten a piece of dough with my palm and crank it through the machine.
I'm wondering if Benton used your concept as the name of his mysterious file because he somehow knew the last precinct, meaning us, would investigate his case someday, I offer.
That we are where he would end up, because whatever was begun with those harassing letters and all the rest of it wasn't going to stop, even with his death.
I turn the dough back through the machine again and again until I have a perfect strip of pasta to lay flat over a towel.
He knew. Somehow he did.
Somehow he always knew everything.
Lucy's face is touched by deep sadness.
Benton is in the kitchen. We feel him as I make Christmas pasta, and we talk about the way his mind worked. He was very intuitive. He always thought far ahead of where he was. I can imagine him projecting himself into a future after his death and imagining how we might react to everything, including a file we might find in his briefcase. Benton would know for a fact that if something happened to him, and he clearly feared something would, then I most certainly would go through his briefcase, which I did. What he may not have anticipated was that Marino would go through the briefcase first and remove a file that I would not learn about until now. By noon, Anna has her car packed for the beach, and her kitchen countertops are covered with lasagna noodles. Tomato sauce simmers on the stove. Parmesan Reggiano and aged Asiago cheeses are grated in bowls, and fresh mozzarella rests in a towel and surrenders some of its moisture. The house smells like garlic and wood smoke, and Christmas lights glow while smoke drifts out the chimney. And when Marino arrives with all his typical noise and gaucheness, he finds more happiness than he has seen from any of us for a while. He is dressed in jeans and a denim shirt, and laden with gifts and a bottle of Virginia Lightning moonshine. I catch the edge of a file folder peeking out from behind wrapped packages in a bag, and my heart skips.
"Ho, ho, ho," he bellows. "Merry fucking Christmas."
It is his standard holiday line, but his heart isn't into it. I have a feeling he didn't spend the past few hours merely looking for the clip file. He has been through it.
"I need a drink," he announces to the house.
Chapter 31. In the kitchen, I set the oven and cook pasta. I mix grated cheeses with ricotta and begin layering it and meat sauce between noodles in a deep dish. Anna stuffs dates with cream cheese and fills a bowl with salted nuts, while Marino, Lucy, and McGovern pour beer and wine, or mix whatever holiday potion they want, which in Marino's case is a spicy Bloody Mary made with his moonshine. He is in a weird mood and well on his way to getting drunk. The clip file is a black hole, still in the bag of presents, ironically under the Christmas tree. Marino knows what's in that file, but I don't ask him. Nobody does. Lucy begins getting out ingredients for chocolate chip cookies and two pies, one peanut butter, the other key lime, as if we are feeding the entire city. McGovern uncorks a Chambertin Grand Cru red burgundy while Anna sets the table, and the file pulls silently and with great force. It is as if all of us have made an unspoken agreement to at least drink a toast and get dinner going before we start talking about murder.
"Anybody else want a bloody?"
Marino talks loudly and hangs out in the kitchen doing nothing helpful.
"Hey, Doc, how about I mix up a pitcher?"
He yanks open the refrigerator and grabs a handful of spicy hot V8 juices and starts popping open the small cans. I wonder how much Marino had to drink before he got here, and the safety comes off my anger. In the first place, I am insulted that he put the file under the tree, as if this is his idea of a tasteless, morbid joke. What is he implying? This is my Christmas present? Or is he so callous it didn't even occur to him that when he rather unceremoniously stuck the bag under the tree, the file was still in it? He bumps past me and starts pressing lemon halves into the electric juicer and tosses the rinds in the sink.
"Well, I guess nobody's going to help me, so I'll just help myself," he mutters. "Hey!" he calls out as if we aren't in the same room with him. "Anybody think to buy horseradish?"
Anna glances at me. A collective bad mood begins to settle in. The kitchen seems to get darker and chillier, and my anger itches. I am going to fire at Marino any minute, and I am trying so hard to hold back. It is Christmas, I keep telling myself. It is Christmas. Marino grabs a long wooden spoon and makes a big production of stirring his pitcher of Bloody Marys as he slops in an appalling amount of moonshine. "Gag," Lucy shakes her head. "At least use Grey Goose."
"Ain't a way in hell I'm drinking French vodka."
The spoon clacks as he stirs and then taps it on the lip of the pitcher.
"French wine, French vodka. Hey, what happened to things Italian?"
He exaggerates a New York Italian accent.
"What happened to the neighborhood?"
"Nothing Italian about that shit you're mixing," Lucy tells him as she gets a beer out of the refrigerator. "You drink all that, Aunt Kay will take you to work with her in the morning. Only you'll be lying down in a bag." Marino chugs a glass of his dangerous concoction.
"That reminds me,"
he says to no one in particular.
"I die, she ain't cutting on me."
As if I am not standing right there.
"That's the deal."
He pours another glass, and by now all of us have stopped what we are doing. We stare at him.
"That's been bothering me for 10 fucking years now." Another swallow. "Damn, this stuff will warm your toes. I don't want her slamming me around on one of those damn steel tables and cutting me up like I'm a fish from the fucking market. Huh. I got a deal with the girls up front."
A reference to my clerks in the front office.
"No passing my pictures around. Don't think I don't see what goes on up there. They compare dick sizes."
He chugs half a glass and wipes his mouth with the back of his hand.
"I've heard him do it. Especially Clita."
He makes a lewd play on Clita's name. He starts for the pitcher again, and I put out my hand to stop him as my anger rushes forth in an army of harsh words.
"That's enough. What the hell's gotten into you? How dare you come here drunk and then get drunker?
Go sleep it off, Marino. I'm sure Anna can find a spare bed. You're not driving anywhere, and none of us care to be subjected to you right now." He gives me a defiant, mocking stare as he lifts his glass again.
"Least I'm being honest," he retorts. "Rest of you can pretend all you want that it's a good damn day because it's fucking Christmas. Well, so fucking what? Lucy's quit her job so she don't get fired because she's a smart-ass queer."
"Don't, Marino," Lucy warns him.
"McGovern quit her job, and I don't know what her deal is."
Pokes a thumb at her, insinuating she may be of Lucy's same persuasion.
"Anna's gotta move out of her own fucking house because you're here and being investigated for murder, and now you're quitting your job. No small fucking goddamn wonder, and we'll just see if the governor keeps you around. A private consultant, yeah."
He slurs his words and sways in the middle of the kitchen, his face blotchy red.
"That'll be the day. So guess who's left? Me, myself, and I."
He slams the glass down on the counter and walks out of the kitchen, bumping into a wall, knocking a painting crooked, stumbling into the living room.
"My God."
McGovern quietly lets out a big breath.
"Redneck bastard," Lucy says.
"The file."
Anna stares after him.
"That is what is wrong with him."
Marino is in a drunken coma on the living room couch. Nothing stirs him. He does not move, but his snoring alerts us that he is both alive and not aware of what is going on inside Anna's house. The lasagna is cooked and staying warm in the oven, and a key lime pie chills inside the refrigerator. Anna has set out on the 8-hour drive to Hilton Head, despite my protests. I did all I could to encourage her to stay, but she felt she should go on. It is mid-afternoon. Lucy, McGovern, and I have been sitting at the dining room table for hours, place settings moved out of the way, gifts still unopened under the tree, the clip file spread out before us. Benton was meticulous. He sealed each item in clear plastic, and purple stains on some of the letters and envelopes indicate ninhydrin was used to process latent fingerprints. The postmarks are Manhattan, all with the same first three digits of a zip code, 100. It is not possible to know which branch posted the letters. All a three-digit prefix indicates is which city, and that the mail wasn't processed through a home or business postage meter machine or at some rural station. In those instances, the postmark would be five digits. There is a table of contents in the front of the clip file, and it lists a total of 63 items dating from the spring of 1996, about 6 months before Benton wrote the letter he wanted delivered to me after his death, to the fall of 1998, mere days before Carrie Grethen escaped from Kirby. The first item is labeled Exhibit 1, as if it is physical evidence for a jury to see. It is a letter posted in New York on May 15, 1996, unsigned and computer-printed in an ornate, hard-to-read, word-perfect font that Lucy identifies as Ransom. Dear Benton, I'm the president of the Ugly Fan Club, and you've been picked to be an honorary member. Guess what? Members get to be ugly for free. Aren't you excited? More later. This was followed by five more letters, all within weeks of each other, all making the same references to an ugly fan club and Benton's becoming the newest member. The paper was plain, same Ransom font, no signature, same New York zip code, clearly the same author for all. And a very clever one until this person mailed the sixth letter and made a mistake. A rather obvious one to the investigative eye, which is why I am baffled that Benton didn't seem to catch it. On the back of the plain white envelope are writing impressions that are noticeable when I tilt the envelope and catch light at different angles. I get a pair of latex gloves out of my satchel and put them on as I wander into the kitchen to find a flashlight. Anna keeps one on the counter by the toaster. Back in the dining room, I slip the envelope out of its plastic cover, hold it up by the corners, and shine the flashlight on the paper obliquely. I catch the shadow of the indented word Postmaster, and it becomes instantly clear to me what the author of this letter did. Franklin D. I make out more words. Is there a Franklin D. Roosevelt post office in New York? Because this definitely says NYNY. Yes. The one in my neighborhood, McGovern says, her eyes getting wild. She comes over to my side of the table to get a closer look. I've had cases where people try to create alibis, I say, shining the light from different angles. An obvious shop-worn one is you were in a different, very distant location at the time of the murder and therefore couldn't have done it. An easy way to do that is have mail posted from some remote location at or around the time the murder happens, thereby making it seem the killer couldn't be you because you can't be in two places at once. Third Avenue, McGovern says. That's where the FDR post office is. We've got part of a street address. Some of it's obliterated by the flap. 9-something-3-AV. Yes, Third Avenue. What you do is address the letter, put on the appropriate postage, then enclose it in another envelope addressed to the postmaster of whatever post office you want your letter mailed from. The postmaster is obliged to mail your letter for you, postmarked in that city. So what this person did was tuck this letter inside another envelope, and when he addressed that outer envelope, the impressions of what he wrote were left on the envelope underneath. Lucy has come behind me, too, and is leaning close to see. Susan Pless's neighborhood, she says. Not only that, but the letter, which is by far the most vile, is dated December 3, 1997, the same day Susan Pless was murdered. "Hey, Benton. How are you, soon-to-be-ugly boy? Just wondering. Got any idea what it's like to look in the mirror and want to commit suicide? No? Will soon. Will soon. Gonna carve you up like a Christmas turkey. And same goes for the chief cunt you screw when you got time off from trying to figure out people like me and you. Can't tell you how much I'm a-gonna," to quote Southerners, "like using my big blade to open her seams. Quid pro quo, right? When you gonna learn to mind your own business?" I imagine Benton receiving these sick, crude missives. I imagine him in his room at my house, sitting at the desk with laptop opened and plugged into a modem line, his briefcase nearby, coffee within reach. His notes indicate he determined the font was ransom and then contemplated the significance. To obtain release by paying a price. To buy back. To deliver from sin. I read his scribbles. I might have been down the hallway in my study or in the kitchen at the very moment he was reading this letter and looking up ransom in the dictionary, and he never said a word. Lucy volunteers that Benton wouldn't have wanted to burden me, and nothing helpful would have come from my knowing. I couldn't have done anything about it, she adds. Cactus, lilies, tulips. McGovern goes through pages of the file. So someone was anonymously sending him flower arrangements at Quantico. I start picking through dozens of message slips that simply have "hang up" written on them, and the date and time. The calls were made to his direct line at the Behavioral Science Unit, all tracing back to "out of area" on caller ID, meaning they were probably made on a cell phone. Benton's only observation was pauses on the line before hanging up. McGovern informs us that flower orders were placed with a Lexington Avenue florist that Benton apparently checked out, and Lucy calls directory assistance to see if that same florist is still in business. It is. He makes a note here about payment. It is so hard for me to look at Benton's small, snarled penmanship. Mail. The orders were placed by mail. Cash. He has the word cash. So it sounds like the person sent cash and a written order. I flip back to the table of contents. Sure enough, Exhibits 51 through 55 are the actual orders received by the florist. I turn to those pages. Computer-generated and unsigned. One small arrangement of tulips for $25 with instructions to send it to Benton's Quantico address. One small cactus for $25 and so on. Envelopes postmarked New York. Probably the same thing, Lucy says. They were mailed through the New York postmaster. Question is, where were they mailed from originally? We can't know that without the outer envelopes, which certainly would have been tossed into the trash the instant post office employees opened them. Even if we had those envelopes, it is highly unlikely the sender wrote out his return address. The most we could have hoped for was a postmark. Guess the florist just assumed he was dealing with some nutcase who doesn't believe in charge cards, McGovern comments. Or someone having an affair. Or an inmate. I am, of course, thinking of Carrie Grethin. I can imagine her sending out communications from Kirby. By slipping the letters in an outer envelope addressed to a postmaster, at the very least she prevented the hospital staff from seeing who she was sending the letters to, whether it was to a florist or to Benton directly. Using a New York post office makes sense, too. She would have had access to various office branches through the telephone directory, and in my gut I don't think Carrie was concerned about anyone supposing the mail originated in the same city where she was incarcerated. She simply didn't want to alert Kirby staff, and she was also the most manipulative person on this planet. Everything she did had its reason. She was just as busy profiling Benton as he was her. If it's Carrie, McGovern somberly remarks, then you do have to wonder if she in any form or fashion was at least privy to Sean Dunn and his killings. She would get off on it, I reply with anger as I push back from the table. And she would know damn well that by writing a letter to Benton dated the same day as Susan's murder would send him through the ceiling. He'd make that connection all right. and picking a post office located in Susan's neighborhood, Lucy adds. We speculate, postulate, and go on until late afternoon, when we decide it is time for Christmas dinner. After rousing Marino, we tell him what we have discovered and continue to talk as we eat greens, sweet onions, and tomatoes drenched in sweet red vinegar and cold-pressed olive oil. Marino shovels in food as if he hasn't eaten in days, stuffing lasagna into his mouth while we debate and speculate and beg the question, if Carrie Grethen was the person harassing Benton and she had some link to the Chandon family, was Benton's murder more than a simple act of psychopathy? Was his slaying an organized crime hit disguised to seem personal, senseless, deranged, with Carrie the lieutenant who was more than eager to carry it out? In other words, Marino says to me with his mouth full, was his death like what you're accused of? The table falls silent. None of us quite get his meaning, but then I do. You're saying if there was a real motive for his murder, but it was disguised to look like a serial killing. He shrugs. Just like you being accused of murdering Bray and disguising it to look like Wolfman did it. Maybe why Interpol got so hot and bothered, Lucy considers. Marino helps himself to excellent French wine he gulps down like Gatorade. Yeah, Interpol. Maybe Benton got all tangled up with the cartel somehow and... Because of Chandon, I interrupt, as my focus sharpens, and I think I am on the trail that might just lead to the truth. Jamie Berger has been our uninvited Christmas guest. She has shaded my thoughts all afternoon. I can't stop thinking about one of the first things she asked when we met in my conference room. She wanted to know if anyone had profiled Chandon's Richmond murders. She was so quick to bring that up and so clearly believes profiling is important. Certainly she would have had someone profile Susan Pless's murder, and I am increasingly suspicious that Benton very well may have known about that case. I get up from the table. Please be home, I say out loud to Berger, and I experience a growing sense of desperation as I dig in my satchel for her business card. On it is her home number, and I call from Anna's kitchen where no one can hear what I say. A part of me is embarrassed. I'm also frightened and mad. If I am wrong, I will sound foolish. If I am right, then she should have been more open with me. Damn it. Damn her. Hello? A woman answers. Miss Berger, I say. Hold on, the person calls out. Mom, for you! The minute Berger gets on the line, I say, what else don't I know about you? Because it's becoming patently clear that I don't know much. Oh, Jill. She must mean the person who answered the phone. Actually, they're from Greg's first marriage. Two teenagers. And today I'd sell them to the first bidder. Hell, I'd pay someone to take them. No, you wouldn't, Jill says in the background and laughs. Let me get to a quieter spot. Berger talks as she moves into some other area of wherever it is she lives with a husband and two children she has never mentioned to me, even after all the hours we spent together. My resentment simmers. What's up, Kay? Did you know Benton? I ask her straight up. Nothing. Are you there? I speak again. I'm here, she says, and her tone has gotten quiet and serious. I'm thinking how best to answer you. Why not start with the truth, for once? I've always told you the truth, she replies. That's ridiculous. I've heard even the best of you lie when you're trying to manipulate someone, suggesting lie detectors or the big needle truth serum to get people to fess up, and there's also such a thing as lying by omission. The whole truth, I demand it. For God's sake, did Benton have something to do with the Susan Pless case? Yes. Berger replies. Absolutely yes, Kay. Talk to me, Ms. Berger. I've just spent the entire afternoon going through letters and other weird things he received before he was murdered. They were processed in the post office located in Susan's neighborhood. A pause. I'd met Benton numerous times, and my office has certainly availed itself of the services the Behavioral Science Unit has to offer. Back then, at least. We actually have a forensic psychiatrist we use now, someone here in New York. I'd worked with Benton on other cases over the years, that's my point. And the minute I learned about Susan's murder and went to the scene, I called him and got him up here. We went through her apartment, just as you and I went through the Richmond crime scenes. Did he ever indicate to you that he was getting strange mail and phone call and other things? And that just possibly there was a connection between whoever was doing it and whoever murdered Susan Pless? I see, is all she says. See? What the hell do you see? I see you know, she answers me. Question is, how? I tell her about the clip file. I inform her that it appears Benton had the documents checked for fingerprints, and I'm wondering who did that and where and what the results might have been. She has no idea, but says we should run any latent prints through the automated fingerprint identification system known as APHIS. There are postage stamps on the envelopes, I inform her. He didn't remove them, and he would have had to if he wanted them checked for DNA. It has only been in recent years that DNA analysis has become sophisticated enough, because of PCR, to make it worthwhile to analyze saliva. And just maybe whoever affixed postage stamps to the envelopes did so by licking them. I'm not sure that even Carrie Grethen would have known back then that licking a stamp might give up her identity to us. I would have known. Had Benton showed these letters to me, I would have recommended he have the stamps examined. Maybe we would have gotten results. Maybe he wouldn't be dead. Back then, a lot of people, even those in law enforcement, just didn't think about things like that. Berger is still talking about the postage stamps. Seems like all cops do these days is follow people for their coffee cups or sweaty towels, Kleenex, cigarette butts. Amazing. I have an incredible thought. What she is saying has brought to mind a case in England where a man was falsely accused of a burglary because of a cold hit on the Birmingham-based National DNA database. The man's solicitor demanded a retest of the DNA recovered from the crime, this time using 10 loci, or locations, instead of the standard 6 that had been used. Loci, or alleles, are simply specific locations on your genetic map. Some alleles are more common than others, so the less common they are and the more locations used, the better your chances for a match, which isn't literally a match, but rather a statistical probability that makes it almost impossible to believe the suspect didn't commit the crime. In the British case, the alleged burglar was excluded upon retesting with additional loci. There was a 1 in 37 million chance of a mismatch, and sure enough, it happened. When you tested the DNA from Susan's case, did you use STR? I ask Berger. STR is the newest technology in DNA profiling. All it means is we amplify the DNA with PCR and look at very discriminating repeat base pairs called short tandem repeats. Typically, the requirement for DNA databases these days is that at least 13 probes or loci be used, thus making it highly improbable that there will be any mismatches. I know our labs are very advanced, Berger is saying. They've been doing PCR for years. It's all PCR unless the lab is still doing the old RFLP, which is very reliable but just takes forever, I reply. In 1997, it was a matter of how many probes you used, or loci. Often, in first screening of a sample, the lab may not do 10, 13, or 15 loci. That gets to be expensive. If only 4 loci were done in Susan's case, for example, you could come up with an unusual exception. I'm assuming the ME's office still has the extraction left in their freezer. What sort of bizarre exception? If we're dealing with siblings, brothers, and one left the seminal fluid and the other left the hair and saliva. But you tested Thomas's DNA, right? And it was similar to Jean-Baptiste's, but not the same? I can't believe it. Berger is getting agitated. We also did that just days ago with 13 loci, not 4 or 6, I reply. I'm assuming the profiles had a lot of the same alleles, but also some different ones. The more probes you do, the more you come up with differences, especially in closed populations. And when you think of the Chandon family, theirs is probably a very closed population, people who have lived on Ile Saint-Louis for hundreds of years, probably married their own kind. in some cases inbreeding, marrying cousins, which might also account for Jean-Baptiste Chandon's congenital deformity. The more people inbreed, the more they up their chances for genetic glitches. We need to retest the seminal fluid from Susan's case, Berger decides. Your labs would do that anyway, since he's up on murder charges, I reply. But you might want to encourage them to make it a priority. God, let's hope it doesn't turn out to be someone else, she says in frustration. Jesus, that would be awful if the DNA doesn't match when they do the retest. Talk about really screwing up my case. She is right. It certainly would. Even Berger might have a hard time making a jury believe that Chandon killed Susan if his DNA doesn't match the DNA of the seminal fluid recovered from her body. I'll get Marino to submit the stamps and any latent prints to the Richmond labs, she then says. And Kay, I need to ask you not to look at anything in that file unless it's witnessed. Don't look any further. That's why it's best you don't submit any evidence yourself. I understand. Another reminder that I am under suspicion for murder. For your own protection, she adds. Miss Berger, if you knew about the letters, about what was happening to Benton, then what did you think when he was murdered? Aside from the obvious shock and grief? That he was killed by whoever was harassing him? Yes, first thing that came to mind. However, when it became clear who his killers were and then they were gunned down, there didn't seem to be anything to pursue further. And if Carrie Grethen wrote those harassing letters, she wrote the worst one, it seems, on the very day Susan was killed. Silence. I think we must consider there could be a connection. I am firm on this point. Susan may have been Chandon's first victim in this country, and as Benton started poking around, he might have started getting too close to other things that point to the cartel. Carrie was alive and in New York when Chandon came there and killed Susan. And maybe Benton was a hit? Berger sounds doubtful. More than maybe, I reply. I knew Benton and the way he thought. For starters, why was he carrying the clip file in his briefcase? Why did he take it with him to Philadelphia if he didn't have some reason to think that the weird stuff in it was connected to what Carrie and her accomplice were doing? Killing people and cutting their faces off, making them ugly. And the notes Benton was getting made it clear he was going to be made ugly, and he sure as hell was. I need a copy of that file. Berger dismisses me. It is obvious by her tone that she suddenly wants to get off the phone. I've got a fax machine here in the house. She gives me the number. I go into Anna's study and spend the next half hour photocopying everything in the clip file because I can't feed laminated documents into the fax machine. Marino finished the burgundy and is asleep on the couch again when I return to the living room, where Lucy and McGovern sit in front of the fire talking, continuing to paint scenarios that are only getting wilder the more they are influenced by alcohol. Christmas speeds away from us. We finally get around to opening gifts at 10:30, and Marino groggily plays Santa, handing out boxes and trying to be festive. But his mood has gotten only darker, and any attempts at humor have a bite. At 11:00, Anna's phone rings. It is Berger. Quid pro quo, she launches in, referring to the letter dated December 3, 1997. How many non-legal-minded people use that term? Just a crazy idea, but wonder if there's a way we could get hold of Rocky Caggiano's DNA. May as well turn over every stone and not be so quick to assume Carrie wrote these letters. Maybe she did, but maybe she didn't. I can't concentrate as I return to Christmas gifts beneath the tree. I try to smile and act abundantly thankful, but I don't fool anyone. Lucy gives me a stainless steel Breitling watch called a B-52, while Marino's gift to me is a coupon for a year of firewood that he will personally deliver and stack. Lucy loves the Whirligirl's necklace I had made for her, and Marino loves the leather jacket from Lucy and me. Anna would be pleased with an art glass vase I found for her, but she is somewhere in I-95, of course. Everybody goes through the motions quickly because questions hang heavy in the air. While we gather up rumpled ribbons and torn paper, I motion to Marino that I need a private word with him. We sit in the kitchen. He has been in some stage of drunkenness all day, and I can tell that he is probably getting drunk on a regular basis. There is a reason for it.
"You can't keep drinking like this," I say to him as I pour each of us a glass of water. "It doesn't help anything."
"Never has, never will," he rubs his face. "And that don't seem to make a damn difference when I'm feeling like shit. Right now everything's shit."
His bleary, bloodshot eyes meet mine. Marino looks like he is about to cry again.
"Any reason you might have something that could give us Rocky's DNA?" I come right out and ask. He flinches as if I have hit him.
"What did Berger tell you when she called? That it? She call about Rocky?"
"She's just going down the list," I reply. "Anybody connected with us or Benton who might have a link to organized crime. And Rocky certainly comes to mind." I go on and tell him what Berger revealed about Benton and the Susan Pless case.
"But he was getting that wacko shit before Susan was murdered," he says. "So why would someone be jerking him around if he wasn't sticking his nose in anything yet? Why would Rocky, for example? And I assume that's what you're thinking, that maybe Rocky was sending him that weird shit."
I have no answer. I don't know.
"Well, I guess you're going to have to get DNA from Doris and me, 'cause I don't got anything of Rocky's, not even hair. You could do that, right? If you got the DNA of the mother and the father, then you could compare something like saliva?
We could get a pedigree, and at least know your son can't be ruled out as a contributor of the DNA on the stamps."
"Okay," he blows out, "if that's what you want to do. Since Anna's split, think I can smoke in here?"
"I wouldn't dare," I reply. "What about Rocky's fingerprints?"
"Forget that. Besides, it didn't look to me like Benton had any luck with the prints. I mean, you can tell he tested the letters for them, and that seems to be the end of it. And I know you don't want to hear this, Doc, but maybe you'd better be sure why you're getting into all this. Don't go on a witch hunt because you want to pay back the fucker who might have sent that shit to Benton and maybe had to do with him being killed. It ain't worth it. Especially if you're thinking Carrie did it. She's dead. Let her rot."
"It is worth it," I say. "If I can know for sure who sent those letters to him, it's worth it to me."
"Huh. He said the last precinct was where he'd end up. Well, looks like he has," Marino muses. "We're the last precinct, and we're working his case. Ain't that something?"
"Do you think he carried that file to Philadelphia because he wanted to make sure you or I got it?"
"Assuming something happened to him?"
I nod.
"Maybe," he says. "He was worried he wasn't going to be around much longer, and he wanted us to find that file if something did happen to him. And it's strange, too. It's not like he says much in it. Almost like he knew other people might see it, and he didn't want anything in it that maybe the wrong person would see. Don't you find it interesting there ain't any names in it? Like if he had suspects in mind, he never mentioned anybody?"
"The file's cryptic," I agree.
"So who was he afraid might see it? Cops? 'Cause if something happened to him, he would know cops are going through his shit. And they did. Philly cops went through everything in his hotel room and then turned it over to me. He would also figure you're going to see his stuff at some point. Maybe Lucy, too.
I think the point is he couldn't be sure of who might see the file, so he was cautious, period. And Benton was certainly known for being cautious.
Not to mention," Marino goes on, "he was up there helping out ATF. So he might have thought ATF would see the file, right? Lucy's ATF, McGovern's ATF, and was in charge of the response team working the fires Carrie and her asshole sidekick were setting to disguise the fact they had this nasty little hobby of cutting people's faces off, right?"
Marino's eyes narrow.
"Tally's ATF," he says. "Maybe we ought to get his DNA, the son of a bitch. Too bad."
He gets that look again. I don't think Marino will ever forgive me for sleeping with Jay Tally.
"You probably had his fucking DNA, no pun intended, in Paris. I don't guess you got a stain you maybe forgot to wash out."
"Shut up, Marino," I say softly.
"I'm getting withdrawal."
He gets up and goes to the liquor cabinet. Now it's time for bourbon. He pours Booker's into a glass and comes back to the table.
"Wouldn't that just be something if it turns out Tally's involved in everything from soup to nuts? Maybe that's why he wanted you at Interpol. He wanted to pick your brain to see if you knew maybe what Benton knew. 'Cause guess what? Maybe when Benton was poking around after Susan's murder, he started figuring out shit that started pulling him too close to a truth Tally can't afford for nobody to know.
What are you two talking about? Lucy is in the kitchen. I didn't hear her walk in.
Sounds like a job for you.
Marino gives her his puffy eyes as he swills bourbon in his glass.
Why don't you and Tion investigate Tally and find out how dirty he is? 'Cause I believe with all my little heart they don't come no dirtier. And by the way, this to me, in case you didn't hear, he's one of the guys who drove Sean Dunn up to New York.
Now ain't that interesting?
He sits in on Berger's interview. He spends 6 hours in the car with him. Hey, they're probably drinking buddies by now. Or maybe they already was.
Lucy stares out the kitchen window, her hands in the pockets of her jeans, obviously put off by Marino and embarrassed by him. He is sweating and profane, and unsteady on his feet, and filled with hate and spite 1 minute, sullen the next.
You know what I can't stand? Marino keeps at it. I can't stand bad cops who get away with it because everybody's too damn chicken to go after them. And nobody wants to touch Tally or even try because he speaks all these languages and went to Harvard and is a big-shot golden boy.
You really don't know what you're talking about, Lucy says to Marino. And by now McGovern has wandered into the kitchen.
You're wrong. Jay's not off limits, and you're not the only person on this planet who has doubts about him.
Serious doubts, McGovern echoes. Marino shuts up and leans against the counter.
I can tell you what we know so far, Lucy says to me.
She is reluctant and soft-spoken because nobody really is quite sure how I feel about Jay. I kind of hate to because there's nothing definitive, but it's not looking good so far. She looks at me as if in search of a cue.
Good, I tell her. Let's hear it. Yeah, I'm all ears, Marino responds.
I've run him through quite a number of databases. No criminal or civil court records, no liens or judgments, etc. Not that we expected him to be a registered sex offender or deadbeat parent or missing or wanted or whatever. And there's no evidence that the FBI, CIA, or even ATF has a file of him in their systems of records. But doing a simple search of real estate records raised a red flag. First of all, he has a condo in New York where he's let certain select friends stay, including high-ranking people in law enforcement, she says to Marino and me. A 3 million-plus place full of antiques on Central Park. Jay has bragged that the condo is his. Well, it's not. Comes back to a corporate name. It's not uncommon for wealthy people to have property in separate corporate names for privacy reasons, and also to protect various assets from litigation, I point out.
I know.
But this corporation isn't Jay's, Lucy replies. Not unless he owns an air freight company.
Kind of eerie, right? McGovern adds. Considering how much shipping the Sean Dunn family is involved in. So maybe there's a connection. It's way too soon to say.
No big surprise, Marino mutters, but his eyes light up.
Yeah, how well I remember him playing the big rich Harvard act, right, Doc? Remember I wondered why we were suddenly on a Learjet, and next thing we're on the Concorde going to France? I knew Interpol didn't pay for all that shit.
He never should have bragged about that condo, Lucy remarks. Obviously he's got the same Achilles heel other assholes do.
Ego.
She looks at me. He wanted to impress you, so he flies you out supersonic. Says he got the tickets comped because they were for law enforcement. And sure, we know the airlines do that sort of thing on occasion. But we're tracking that, too, to see who made those reservations and what the story was.
My big question, McGovern goes on, is obviously whether or not that condo might be owned by the Sean Dunn family, and you can only imagine how many layers you'd have to go through to get to them.
Hell, they probably own the whole fucking building, Marino says, and half of Manhattan to go along with it.
What about corporate officers, I ask. Any interesting names come up?
We've got names, but they don't mean anything significant yet, Lucy replies. These paper cases take a lot of time. We run them and then everything and everybody they connect with, on and it goes.
And where do Mitch Barbosa and Rosso Matos fit in? I ask. Or do they? Because somebody took a key out of my house and put it in Barbosa's pocket. Do you think Jay did?
Marino snorts and takes a swallow of bourbon. Gets my vote, he retorts.
That and swiping your chipping hammer. Can't think of anybody else who'd do it. I know every guy who went in there, in your house. Unless Ryder did it, and he's too chicken, and I really don't think he's dirty.
It isn't that Jay's shadow hasn't crossed our thoughts numerous times before. We know he was in my house. We know he is bitter toward me. We all have considerable questions about his character, but if he did plant the key or steal it from my house and pass it off to someone else, then this directly implicates him in Barbosa's torture homicide, and most likely in Matos's as well.
Where's Jay right now? Anybody know? I search their faces.
Well, he was in New York. That was Wednesday. Then we saw him yesterday afternoon in James City County. Got no idea right this very minute, Marino answers.
There are a couple other things you might want to know. Lucy addresses this to me. One in particular is real odd, but I can't make head or tails of it yet. On the credits search, I got hits on 2 J tallies with different addresses and different social security numbers. 1 J tally was issued his social security number in Phoenix between 1960 and 1961, which couldn't be J unless he's in his 40s, and he's what, not much older than me? Early 30s at the most? A second J tally I got a hit on was issued his social security number between 1936 and 37. No DOB, but he'd have to be one of the early-timers who got a number shortly after the Social Security Act of 1935, so God knows how old he already was when this particular J. Tally got his number. He'd have to be at least in his 70s, and he sure moves around a lot and uses post office boxes instead of physical addresses. He's also bought a lot of cars, sometimes changing vehicles a couple times a year.
Did Tally ever tell you where he was born? Marino asks me.
He said he spent most of his childhood in Paris and then his family moved to L.A., I reply. You were sitting in the cafeteria when he said that, at Interpol. No record of either J. Tally ever living in L.A., Lucy says.
And speaking of Interpol, Marino says, wouldn't they check him out before letting him work there?
Obviously they might have checked into him, but not extensively, Lucy replies. He's an ATF agent. You assume he's clean.
What about a middle name? Marino asks. We know his.
He doesn't have one. Nothing in his ATF personnel records, McGovern smiles wryly. And neither does the J. Tally who got his social security number back before the Great Flood. That alone is unusual. Most people have middle names. In his file at headquarters, it does say he was born in Paris and lived there until he was 6. But after that, he supposedly moved to New York with his French father and American mother, and there's no mention of Los Angeles. On his ATF application, he claims to have gone to Harvard, but having looked into that, we discovered there's no record of any J. Tally having ever attended Harvard.
Jesus, Marino exclaims.
Don't people check out nothing when they go through these applications?
They just take your word for it that you went to Harvard or were a Rhodes Scholar or pole vaulted in the Olympics? And they hire you and give you a badge and a gun?
Well, I'm not going to give Internal Affairs a heads up that they may want to check him out a little more closely, McGovern offers. We've got to be careful someone doesn't tip him off, and it's hard to say who his friends are at headquarters.
Marino lifts his arms in the air and stretches. He cracks his neck. I'm hungry again, he says.
Chapter 32. The guest room in Anna's house faces the river, and over passing days I have fashioned a makeshift desk before the window. This required a small table, which I covered with a cloth so I would not scratch the satin finish, and from the library I purloined an apple-green English leather swivel chair. At first I was dismayed that I had forgotten my laptop computer, but I discovered an unexpected solace in putting fountain pen to paper and letting thoughts flow through my fingers and shimmer in black ink. My penmanship is awful, and the notion that it has something to do with being a doctor is probably true. There are days when I must sign my name or initials 500 times, and I suppose scribbling gross descriptions and measurements with bloody gloved hands has taken its toll, too. I have developed a ritual at Anna's house. Each morning I slip into the kitchen and pour myself a cup of coffee that was timed to begin dripping at exactly 5:30. I return to my room, shut the door, and sit at the window writing before a glass square of utter darkness. My first morning here I was outlining classes I am scheduled to teach at the Institute's next death investigation school. But transportation fatalities, asphyxia, and forensic radiology completely left my mind as life on the river was touched by first light. This morning I have faithfully watched the show once again. At 6:30, the darkness lightened to a charcoal gray, and within minutes I could make out the silhouettes of bare sycamores and oaks, then dark plains turned into water and land. Most mornings the river is warmer than the air, and fog rolls over the surface of the James. Right now it looks like the river sticks, and I halfway expect a ghostly, gaunt man in rags to pole by in his boat through veils of mist. I don't expect to see animals until closer to 8, and they have become a huge comfort to me. I have fallen in love with the Canada geese that congregate by Anna's dock in a chorus of honking. Squirrels run errands up and down trees, tails curled like plumes of smoke. Birds hover at my window and look me straight in the eye as if to see what I am spying on. Deer run through bare winter woods on the opposite riverbank, and red-tailed hawks swoop. At rare privileged moments I am graced by bald eagles. Their enormous wingspans, white helmets and pantaloons make them unmistakable, and I am comforted because eagles fly higher and alone, and don't seem to have the same agendas other birds do. I watch them circle or perch briefly in a tree, never staying in one spot long before suddenly they are gone, leaving me to wonder, like Emerson, if I have just been sent a sign. I have found nature to be kind. The rest of what I live with these days is not. It is Monday, January 17, and I remain in exile at Anna's house, or at least this is how I view it. Time has passed slowly, almost stagnantly, like the water beyond my window. The currents of my life are moving in a certain, barely perceptible direction, and there is no possibility of rerouting their inevitable progress. The holidays have come and gone, and my cast has been replaced by ace bandages and a splint. I am driving a rental car because my Mercedes is being held for further investigation at Hull Street and Commerce Road, at the impound lot, which is not attended by police 24 hours a day, and there is no guard dog. On New Year's Eve, someone smashed a window out of my car and stole the two-way radio, the AM-FM radio, and CD player, and God knows what else. So much for the chain of evidence, I told Marino. There are new developments in the Chandon case. As I suspected, when the seminal fluid in Susan Pless's case was originally tested in 1997, only 4 probes were used. The New York Medical Examiner's Office still uses 4 probes for the first screening because they are developed in-house, and therefore it is more economical to resort to them first. The frozen extraction was retested using 15 loci, and the result is a non-match. Jean-Baptiste Chandon was not the donor of the seminal fluid, nor was his brother Thomas. But there are so many alleles in common, the DNA profiles are so incredibly close, that we can only assume there is a third brother, and it is this brother who had sex with Susan. We are baffled. Berger is on her head. DNA has told the truth and fucked us, Berger told me over the phone. Chandon's dentition matches the bite marks, and his saliva and hair were on the bloody body, but he did not have vaginal sex with Susan Pless right before she died. That may not be enough for a jury in this day of DNA. A New York grand jury will have to decide if it is enough for an indictment, and it struck me as incredibly ironic when Berger said this. It doesn't seem to require much to accuse me of murder, nothing more than rumor and alleged intent, and the fact that I conducted experiments with a chipping hammer and barbecue sauce. For weeks I have waited for the subpoena, Yesterday it arrived, and the sheriff's deputy was his usual cheerful self when he showed up at my office, not realizing, I suppose, that the case this time involves me as a defendant and not an expert witness. I have been asked to appear in room 302 of the John Marshall Courts building to testify before the special grand jury. The hearing is set for Tuesday, February 1, at 2 p.m. At a few minutes past 7, I stand inside the closet, pushing through suits and blouses as I run through all I need to do this day. I already know from Jack Fielding that we have 6 cases and 2 of the doctors are in court. I also have a 10 o'clock telephone conference with Governor Mitchell. I pick out a black pantsuit with blue pinstripes and a blue blouse with French cuffs. I wander into the kitchen for another cup of coffee and a bowl of high-protein cereal that Lucy brought over. I have to smile as I practically break my teeth on her healthy, crunchy gift. My niece is determined that I will emerge from my smoldering life a fit phoenix. I rinse dishes and finish getting dressed and am heading out the door when my pager vibrates. Marino's number shows up on the video display and is followed by 911. Parked in Anna's driveway is the latest change in my life, the rental car. It is a midnight blue Ford Explorer that smells like ancient cigarettes and will always smell like ancient cigarettes unless I do what Marino suggested and stick an air freshener on the dash. I plug my cell phone into the cigarette lighter and call him.
"Where are you?" he asks right off.
"Heading out the driveway." I turn on the heater and Anna's gates open to let me out. I don't even stop to pick up the newspaper, which Marino next tells me I need to see, because clearly I haven't read it yet or I would have called him right away. "Too late," I tell him. "I'm already on Cherokee." I harden myself like a little kid flexing his stomach muscles when he dares someone to sock him in the gut.
"So go on and tell me. What's in the paper?"
I am expecting that the special grand jury investigation has been leaked to the press, and I am right. I drive along Cherokee as recent winter weather continues to dissolve in drips and puddles, and slushy snow sluggishly slides off roofs.
"Chief medical examiner suspected in grisly slaying," Marino reads the banner headline on the front page. "It's got a picture of you, too," he adds. "Looks like one maybe that bitch took out in front of your house. The lady that fell on the ice, remember? It shows you climbing in my truck. Pretty good of my truck. Not so hot of you. Just tell me what it says," I interrupt him. He reads the highlights as I hug the hard curves of Cherokee Road. A Richmond special grand jury is investigating me in the murder of Deputy Police Chief Diane Bray, the newspaper says. The revelation is described as shocking and bizarre and has local law enforcement reeling. Although Commonwealth's attorney Buford Ryder refused